everybody. It is Sherry Dotterer again here from the Writing Glitch podcast. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on where you listen to the podcast. And I bet you're wondering, why do I do that? Well, it was a little tidbit I learned over when I was on Clubhouse almost exclusively all day long for a while, talking to people from China and South Africa and all kinds of different places all over the world. It was like, oh yeah, well, it's morning where you are, but it's nighttime where I am. So that's why I say that. And I don't know if anybody realized why I do that, but that is why. So I have a story to tell you before I get to our interview today. It has been really a struggle for me to get to share this with you, but this is why and how I got started in this whole process is I had just lost a job for ineffective communication. That was like the third or fourth one along my career as a professional. I mean, it was devastating to have somebody say, sorry, we don't like you just because you didn't do your documentation correctly. And like, what? So anyway, it kind of precipitated a fight at home and off I went and I found myself, don't even remember, know how I got there. I found myself sitting in a parking lot at a hotel and going, okay, why am I here? What am I doing? What is going to change my life? And it was at that point in time, I was like, yeah, I need to do something a little bit different than the traditional therapist role. I need to find something that is different and unique. And that's when I really started to come up to really find the courage within myself to look for something new to do. And lo and behold, I came home and I started really looking at what I was doing as a therapist in the schools and where was a gap in the education. And today's guest is Jeffrey Benson. He has been in the school system for many, many, many years. I'm going to share more details about him in just a moment. And I think where I come from with this difficulty with communication, I think you're going to understand why I feel like he is going to be a fantastic interview today. So welcome to the podcast, Mr. Benson. It is Mr. Benson or is it Dr. Benson?
It is Jeffrey.
It's just Jeffrey. Got it.
Much easier.
So I'm going to read his bio to you. So forgive me if I am not looking at the camera for a few minutes, but it's going to just be easier just to read it. Jeffrey Benson has over 40 years of experience as a teacher, mentor, and school administrator. He is passionate in supporting schools to be more successful with more students. He is internationally known author of the books Hanging In, Strategies for Working with the Students Who Challenge Us Most, 10 Steps for Managing Challenging Change in Schools, Teaching the Whole Teen, Everyday Practices That Promote Success and Resilience in School and Life. Man, those three books sound like they could change a teacher's life. Okay, and his newest book, there it is, Hacking School Discipline Together.
Jeffrey, there's another one in there. It's the one,
Improve Every Lesson Plan with SEL. I'm going to have to, like, rearrange how I put the stuff down in front of me so that I don't get lost in my convergence insufficiency going from line to line. There you go.
Which isn't always easy.
It isn't always easy. Now, so there's five books there. Mind blown. Jeffrey leads school change initiatives, facilitating interdisciplinary teams that convert long-lasting dilemmas into cutting-edge growth, community building, and creating more inclusive school and classroom cultures. He is a member of the ASCD faculty. So if anybody understands what that is, that's like a big deal in the world of education. He has frequently published in education journals, speaks at conferences on topics on working with changing students, integrating SEL into everyday practice, restorative practices, decision-making skills for leaders, and the science of learning and teaching. His website is jeffreybenson.org. And welcome to the podcast. Let me just head over here to your website here so that people can see, if they're watching us on YouTube, what your homepage looks like so that they know that they found the right place. So great. We have teaching and learning and leading. We've got you right there in the corner, educator, author, and consultant, and there's those books.
I have a wonderful webmaster, by the way. If anyone wants a recommendation, write to me through my website, and I can connect you with her. She's, I can't do anything like this. She's the best.
That's great. And then you can set in your email and your name and contact Jeffrey. So without further ado, let's get into this conversation about SEL and interdisciplinary teams, because that is where my passion lies, is creating interdisciplinary teams to help kids with their writing. So social emotional learning, it needs to be across the entire education system. It's a big buzzword right now, though. How do you recommend that teachers integrate restorative discipline into their lesson plans by creating this interdisciplinary team?
Going back to this notion of what SEL is, which is the buzz abbreviation for social emotional learning. So I want to start off with this notion that I don't know a single teacher who doesn't have an implicit social emotional learning expectation for their kids every year. Mm-hmm. Each of us slightly differently. Minimally, we always want kids to be polite, to say please, thank you, take turns. That's a social emotional curriculum. When my kids were little in school, if I had heard that their teacher wasn't asking them to please say please or thank you and let them be rude in class, I think that person was being negligent in their duties. On the other hand, no one has that in their job description, to teach kids to be polite. We all do a version of this. So part of how we integrate social emotional learning into schools is just working with teachers, working with teams of teachers, and say, what do you do implicitly already? Let's go from implicit to explicit. That's the first step. Just what are those things you wish your kids would grow with you through this year? So for instance, my kids in my classes heard this endlessly, a couple of things. One was, you have beautiful brains. Wow. And I taught my kids little bits about how brains work. And you can teach kids from third grade, their earlier versions, through high school, through adults, this is how brains work. This is how brains learn. So I would say to my students, I wouldn't say, tell me what the right answer is. I would say, Sherry, what's going on in your neural network now? What are you thinking about? Because the only right answer is, what are you thinking about? Tell me what's going on there. And I want to take away all the barriers between your brain and my brain. Because if I'm going to be successful in helping you do this really challenging thing of learning, and learning in this public forum, by the way, I need to make this, as we say, as safe and brave a classroom as possible. So I do a lot of, oh, you all have beautiful brains and they're all different. Sherry's going to be thinking something different than Jeffrey's thinking. I love that about all of you. And I'm so fascinated. And if you're thinking the same thing, wonderful. Some of us are always going to think the same things. And then there's going to be somebody in class who has a completely different notion. Wow, amazing. So that's just part of the flow. But built into lesson plans. So imagine if you had one and one of yours was asking kids to advocate. I would look at my lesson plan and I'd say, where am I going to today make that explicit? Okay, class, this is something we do in this class. We learn to advocate for what we need. So let's go in, going into this lesson. I, as the teacher, thinking you might want to advocate in this lesson for sitting in a place with more light or less light. You might want to advocate for having blank paper or graph paper or lined paper. Some of you do better with one of those. You might want to advocate in this one for being able to take a break periodically, because this is a long bit of time. And some of you, after a minute, might just need to say, can I put my head down for a minute? Absolutely, you're welcome to do that. In this class, we advocate for how we need to be learners. So imagine if we had in a school or in a system, and this is some of the work I do, starting in kindergarten, how do kids in kindergarten advocate and what can they advocate for? How does that developmentally look in third grade, in fifth grade, in seventh grade? By the time to get to high school, few high school teachers, they have now had years of this is how school goes. This is how we roll in school. This is the culture of school. I am taught a menu of things that I get to advocate for. And I have a conversation with my teacher about how to do that. And every lesson, my teacher reminds me in different places, this is a time to advocate. The other thing I heard from my students, my students heard from me a lot was, how is your effort here helping the class learn? Because in this class, We are interdependent, which means we all learn with each other. This is not a competition for who's fast, who's first, who's loudest, who's quietest. All of our efforts together are to make everyone in this class learn better. So, Sherry, what are you doing now? Is that helping anyone besides you at this point in the class? Because right now there are things you can do to help everybody. So that was the other thing they heard from me a lot. Schools are not set up in general to think of that we are a learning community, and that comes first ahead of individual accomplishment. I'll say one more thing, then I'll have to jump in. That one of the goals of schools is to prepare our kids to be responsible and active members of whatever community they end up in, whether it's the next class next year, whether it's on the job, whether it's in their families, whether it's in their religious communities, whether it's on sports teams they play. People are interdependent in this world. And I think the best first laboratory for doing that is a classroom. You have kids coming in from all different families, often from very different cultures and different neighborhoods. And we say, we're going to be here together for a whole year doing this. What a great opportunity for us to help kids understand that responsibility. And I want to say, and I say this all the time, not as an extracurriculum. It is built into the fiber of how we talk about this every day to kids. So they're coming into class, and I know they have a group work to do, and I say, remember, the first job as we're about to do group work is to make sure everyone at your table has all their supplies. So everybody is responsible for everyone. We can't start until everyone can say everyone has all their supplies. And so now they're ready to learn. They've learned how to do that. It's not an extra curriculum. It's just how we should be always talking with kids.
I'm going to jump back, like, way back. You were talking about the mind. And my passion is creating learning environments that are going to facilitate learning through positive brain function. Yeah. And one of the areas that my co-author and I are writing about is the fact that we need to empower the child before we can actually get any learning done for them. And so one of the things that she as a teacher does, no matter how they answer, whether it's correct, whether it's wrong, whether it's totally doesn't make any sense at all, or is just right on point. You know, they have that whole gamut of right, but and stuff. Anyway, everything is brilliant. And it really does sometimes take those kids who always know the right answer kind of off guard when you are saying to a kid who they know gave you the wrong answer and you say, that was brilliant. They look at you like, what? But after a couple years of working with her, they've kind of caught on and they don't react that way. But those first couple times that she says that, it's like, whoa. So I'm there as the support. I'm not there directly teaching. So she gets to say that a lot more than I do. I'm there going, you know, instead of using this, we might want to try doing it that way and trying to help the student spontaneously on the spot adapt what they're doing with their writing skills so that they can achieve success, even if it might have a different paper or a different pencil or different,
right,
something different about their writing, but really working together. Another thing that we really advocate for is really understanding our own body. So that whole understanding of interoception, metacognition, perseverance are really the first things that we look at when we're developing a multidisciplinary lesson plan. So thank you for saying that, because it really does need to be thought about in how we can both collaborate together to make the lesson plan work.
Let me give you a similar tool that I use and a lot of people I've worked with and coached use, because it gets you to the same place. There's an old saying, there are many ladders into the pool. And the latter, we're going to the place of saying to kids, you have a beautiful brain and what your brain generates is worthy. And so here's an example. If I say to you, how much is 2 + 2? And you say 5. I'll say, fascinating. Wow, I'm totally fascinated how you got 5. Most people get 4. And I won't let, parenthetically, the kid leave the class thinking 2 and 2 is 5. I'll say, how'd you get to 5? Tell me more about that. I'm always fascinated at how you get places. And then the kid, hopefully because we made a safe and brave place in which you can talk about how you're thinking. The kid said, I did this. I'm like, oh, whoa, amazing thinking. But look, you moved 3 blocks over here and you actually meant to move 2. And there's where you went from 4 to 5. But look at all the amazing thinking you did. We always have to be helping kids get there and think about that, to be fascinated by what they're thinking. I want to go back to similar to what you were saying before too. You may know this, 90% of the questions we ask in school are guess what the teacher's thinking questions. So we're not really asking kids what they think. We're asking them to guess the right answer that we, the teacher, are thinking, which is why only 5 kids out of 25 kids usually raise their hands in class. They've bought out of that game a long time ago. Mm-hmm. If I say, what are you thinking? That's the right answer. And by the way, if you write to me at my website, jeffreybenson.org, I have a long list of the sorts of questions you can ask kids when you want to get their gears turning and for them to realize that you love hearing their gears turn. One of my snarky teenagers, so I've taught literally pre-K through graduate school and adults and all that. One of my snarky teenagers once said to me, Mr. B, why do they ask so many questions they already know the answer to? And then my corollary was, and why do they think because one kid in the class answers the question that anyone else's brain has grown through doing the thinking? The fact that one kid answers the question, the teacher goes, yep, that's right. And what do we know about brain science too? Your brain grows more.
What about that kid on the other end of the room who went, huh?
Right. And is it a safe and brave place for the kid to say, wait, just because Sherry answered that, actually, I'm not sure about that. No, but we can do that to make it. How do you advocate for yourself in this class? You always are welcome to ask if you're confused. I had a student once.
I love it when the students actually create the syllabus themselves. Now, granted, the teacher has criterion that they have to create, but I love it when the students come up with the project that's going to meet the needs of the standards. Right. One of my dreams is to have the entire school district, every student in the school, participate in preparations to do a 5K. So it could be a color run or something like that. But from the kindergarten kids all the way to those graduating, every one of those kids could have a role in the preparations to pull it off.
Right. And so I want to bring that even to the classroom part of that in some ways. Because I think, and again, for teachers listening to here, it is the responsibility of the adults to say there's a body of skills and content that I am responsible for helping you work through this year. Or as the saying is, I'm responsible for helping us uncover, not to cover the curriculum, but to help the kids uncover the curriculum. And if you're set up a place where it feels great to ask questions, great to raise your hand and say, wait, I don't understand. Great to say, I have an idea. It doesn't take long for the kids to start saying, what if I did this? What if I did that? Could I do this? Now, sometimes I've said to kids, you could do that, but I want to let you know, for the last 1,000 years, people have explored that and no one's got any farther than what I told you. But maybe you need to go down that road and maybe you'll be the 1,001st person who discovers something else. And some kids will go, really? Everyone's gone there? I'm like, yeah. They'll go, all right, no. But I had this middle school student. We were discussing irrational numbers, the numbers that just go on the decimals forever. And she couldn't believe that that was true. I was like, I said to her, you know, this has been an issue for years. And we've all explored, all of us have done math. It's kind of fascinating and mysterious and cool because numbers are so cool. I said, why don't you, here's a calculator, take a pad of paper, chair in the hallway, go by yourself, explore it. Try all different experiments. Come in and tell me, maybe you found something, maybe not. And about 10 minutes later, she comes in the class. She looks like she's just been in a World War I trench. She goes, he's right, there are no ends. This was her moment of having that aha experience of, But I couldn't take that from her. The fact that I tell kids my construction of the world, it's sometimes a job of adults. You know, I don't want you to get hit by a car to find that the car's hurt. There are other things in which if we don't let them construct and make a mess, Mm-hmm. They'll never learn. There's a great article from one of my favorite articles. I should do my own little video on this. It's called Messing About in Science by David Hawkins. And it's this notion that you've got to experiment, that the reason the great scientists got where they did is they messed around with bobs and pendulums and water and stuff like that. If we just ask the kids to say, you're going to learn this by doing this experiment, they don't even have to do the experiment. Or, oh, no, that's wrong. You didn't do the experiment right. Versus, as we were guys saying earlier, wow, how'd you get the water to spill over your table? What can we learn from that?
Yeah, you're making me think about the electric car. I don't want to get a political.
Tell me, Sherry, tell me what that beautiful brand of yours is thinking about that.
Yes.
I wasn't thinking that. Tell me.
No. I get it. I get it. So my husband was the 2023 Anilani region chapter here in Pennsylvania of the Antique Automobile Club of America. And one of the articles that he wrote for the newsletter was the history of the electric car. Do you know the electric car was invented before the combustion engine?
Amazing, right?
Okay. The problem was the batteries were so big, it was too heavy to move the car. But look at what has happened over time. So when we think about these beautiful brains, somebody in the late 1800s, early 1900s started this process. And now we have a thing called Tesla. And I'm not saying one way or another that I agree or disagree with the whole electric car phenomenon that's happening, but look at all the brains that have come together to get to where we are today. Plus, where are we going to be in the future? Because, you know, that dream of the flying car is still out there.
Yeah, I know. I worry about that as much as I worry about regular cars. So let me talk again about like a classroom level application of all of this. Because I think there are probably some teachers out there saying, yeah, but most kids are not going to become the world's famous scientists and do that. And we have to make sure they have these competencies, which is true. I want them to feel as if their ideas are as wonderful as anyone else's ideas. Even if they don't end up becoming a famous inventor, it's that they have to invent their lives. They have to solve all of the problems of their own lives. And each of our lives is unique in its own challenges and resources and how we grow and where we are. And everyone has to learn to navigate their own lives. So how do we support kids in doing that and feeling competent to navigate the challenges? So I'm a huge proponent of having a do now activity when kids walk in the room. I don't like herding cats when kids come in. I want them to say to them, there's a task. Because it's always better to tell kids what to do than what not to do. Instead of me saying, Sherry, stop talking to your friend, I could say, Sherry, check the do now out. So there's always something to say kids positively to do. But if we only have one do now, it's win, lose, right, wrong. So I always advocate with little kids three up high school, I can have five or six choices to say, and it could be, some of them could be create a poem based on the short story we read yesterday. I'll use a language arts one. It could be reread the story we read yesterday, because sometimes kids do need to reread and say and jot a few ideas that you didn't realize from yesterday. It could be here's an article background about the author. It could be take one paragraph from the story and rewrite it in your own words. It could be write what happens to this character after the story ended. You don't have to make it like a long story, but like write a few bullet points. What do you think happened? And I've done this for years. And again, on my write to me, and I can give you a list of how to do multiple do nows. Here's the upside of it.
So before you do that, I just want to say, so from the OT part of me on that board, my brain will be going, okay, what activities can we get from K through 12 to be able to do that they can do on their own after we teach them how to do it? That creates crossing midline, that creates bilateral integration, that creates those movements and prepares the brain for the actual writing task. So on that, think about this, teachers that are listening to the conversation. What are some of the activities that you can incorporate that create movement that are going to facilitate the brain function? So activity, you also have the functional component as
well. Love that. I love OT, by the way. I once walked through I was a principal of a high school. It was, of course, and I knew about OT, but I hadn't really, had a full dive into it. And I'm walking through the building with the OT person going to a meeting, and she just starts telling me all these things about sounds and lights and textures and smells. And I'm like, I'm an idiot. Like, I didn't know any of that stuff. I was like, oh my God, it's a whole other way of looking at how kids function. And typical, neurotypical people manage those difficulties, those little sensual stresses. Okay. If you have some level of not atypical, a little neurodiverse, those things can really interfere with how you function.
You talking about smell is going to drive me crazy, because as I was coming up the steps, I realized that the bread machine just got finished. The aroma filtering around my house smells absolutely wonderful today.
Love that. So here's, okay, I'm going to do another.
I actually had to do some math to do it because the recipe was in grams and I had cups.
Here's a little parenthetical thing from my experience. I have a very poor sense of smell. I smell some things, but I don't smell a lot. I don't smell robustly. My wife has, like, I always joke, my wife can smell the rose across the street that's just about to bud. I have a really sensitive sense of sound. I'm a musician as well. And my wife so-so. So when she's cooking something, she has the hood fan on because she doesn't want the house. And I hate the sound of the hood fan. And so the question is, at what point has the smell diminished enough so we can turn the hood fan off? And if I was in a classroom in which the teacher was not as sensitive to sound as me and had a loud fan on, oh my God, I would just be like, half my brain would be like, I can't stand that sound. Whereas for my wife, if she's in a classroom that has some odd odors, so it's just having that sensitivity. I want to go all the way back to the do now because I want to finish that notion. So I have five do nows on the board. And yes, I love the notion of also having some bilateral movement. For instance, put the paper on the left side of the desk and write with your right hand on the left side of the desk. And we can kind of invent those things. In all the years I've done it, and I've done it for years and years and years, almost never did a kid pick something that wasn't fascinating for them to do. Because kids don't want to be bored. So occasionally a kid would come in and say, Mr. B, I'm just going to read the story from yesterday because that's about as much as I could do. And I said, good choice. But mostly they chose things that were fascinating. And I would go to them and say, Sherry, you chose number three. Cool. Tell me about choosing number three. And I have this great conversation about their brain and I affirm what they're doing. So multiple new, and as you were kind of coming back to, I am gearing up their brain and getting their neural networks lit up, which I could say to even my third graders. I'm lighting up your neural network to get ready for this next task. Because I know that if your brain is lit up, when I give you something new, it's going to attach really easily to what we've done before. So your brains are all warmed up. Now, it doesn't matter if you do number one or number two or number three. I never said one's easier or harder. Find the one that speaks to you today. And almost everyone dives into the work. It's quite something. And sometimes if there's a kid for whom choice is hard or because of a particular disability of some sort, I might come up to the kid and I might say, Sherry, last night when I was doing the list, number four, I was thinking you would love because you love drawing boxes. You want to give number four a shot? Now, you might say, no, I don't want to draw boxes today. I'm going to do number two. Well, you have a right to make that choice and maybe not have a good experience. That's your right. But it was also to help the kid not get lost in the choice. You know, it's kind of paternalistic reducing of too many options for some kids. I always wanted kids to want to come into my room. I wanted the classroom to be safer and better than the hallway. And so coming in and having that activity right away was like, oh, here's what we do. And then it was the beginning of class was always so, in a nice way, predictable. Not that the task was predictable, but that the routines are really important for kids to feel safe. Mm-hmm. Not rigid ones that never change, but that kids know how to operate in a class is really important. I'll say one more piece. And do I have an article coming out in this? Yes, I do. It's coming out in the March issue of Ed Leadership. It's about administrators and teachers letting kids know our operating manual. We often say we would like kids to cooperate, but most of that means we just want them to obey, right? Can you kids cooperate today? It just means obey. But if I could tell them what the operating manual of the class is, then they can cooperate. So for instance, going back to advocacy, if the kids at every grade know what is allowed to be advocated for in that room and how to do it, they now have the operating manual in which to then cooperate. So let kids know what your tendencies are. Let them know what the predictability is in the class, and your grades will be safer. Okay, can I say one more piece on this?
Sure.
I want to talk about how all brains work and how brains need to feel safe in order to function at their heights, and how what our brains do when we're not feeling safe. So all of us, when we're driving, I know this because I've done this with I've probably done this with 10,000 educators at least. I told this story and everyone goes, yep, I'm driving down the highway, listening to the radio, listening to a podcast, listening to my music, because that's where I get to listen to my band's music, having a good time going down the highway. I know where I'm going to exit 42. I get off exit 42 and I'm going down the road, and now I have to find an address I've never been to before. And I do what all of us instinctually do. I go forward and I turn down the volume. Did anyone ever tell any of this? By the way, when you're trying to find a visual cue, turn down the volume when you're driving. No one has ever told any of us this, that, and yet 100% of us do this. 100%, because what the human brain has evolved to do is to shut down stimulation that doesn't feel vital to what is most important to us right now. And so what might not feel vital to us right now is the assignment the teacher is giving us, because I have a lot of other things that right now coming into this room. So opening rituals are really important, and a do now is a good opening ritual. I need to say this is a safe and brave place, because now I'm going to ask you to do something really challenging, which is learn this new curriculum. And I want to be able to talk to you about how your brain's working. First things first, safe and brave. Make a safe and brave place, and then I can push the kids really as hard as I can to do the curriculum. Because otherwise they're turning us down the way we turn the music down. They got something else they have to attend to.
I love this. I love this. One of the things that you keep saying are three words. Tell me more.
Oh, my favorite three words in English.
Yeah. Tell me more is one of the premier ways of finding out what the child is feeling and thinking. So feelings are also one of those things that we don't address as the adults in the classroom enough. If we don't find out what they're feeling, we can't even figure out what they're thinking. And sometimes it's the other way around. Sometimes the thinking is easier and the feeling is harder to describe and articulate.
Right.
But we also need to teach them to be able to articulate feeling. And so tell me more is one of those strategies and one of those ways that we can dig a little deeper into the thinking feeling connection.
Totally. So much to say about that. Totally true. So one is, I think a lot of us in schools, teachers feel like I'm not a therapist, and or if I go down that road, it's going to take a lot of time. I'm going to hear something I don't want to hear. That's the minority of the time. And we shouldn't deny the kids who can benefit greatly by us asking them that, because of a fear of a few kids. And we do this in schools a lot. We limit what 20 to 25 kids in a class can do that are in their developmental readiness, because three kids are not going to be handling it well. I like to flip that paradigm. Make those other 20 to 25 kids be the heroes of the class and support those three kids who are struggling. So maybe one of those kids, I know I'm not going to ask them to tell me more in terms of their feelings, because this isn't the time and place to do it. This kid's going to feel shamed. This kid's going to feel challenged. Second part on that is we should have a vertical curriculum through schools of emotion words, so that kids get a vocabulary of words to talk to us that aren't just mad, glad, or sad. I want my high school kids to know the word ambivalent. I want them to know the word passionate.
Complacent is one of those words that sticks to me a lot, because that's one of the feelings that kids get about school.
Yeah. And I want them to have, so that's one of the things we can do. If we're teaching vocabulary, let's teach that, because it gives us entry to their brains, which I want to keep coming back to. I want entry to their brains so that I can then say, what if you double that number? I think you would find that really interesting. What if you added a different adjective? You want to go online, go to the thesaurus. There's so many great adjectives. See if there's an adjective you like better, because they're ready for that. Tell me more. I love tell me more. It's my go-to when I forget. But can I say one more thing? There was a survey done in schools about questions and things we ask kids in schools, and asking them to reflect on their emotions is one of the least things we do in school. And I understand why. I'm not blaming teachers. I'm just saying, you know what? We could do it.
It's really the first thing that we should be talking about. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds counterintuitive, but if we aren't able to access feelings, we're not going to be able to access learning.
Here's after my students do their due now, because I want them to always come in. We have this moment where I'll say to the class, all right, before we go into the next part of the lesson, is there anything Mr. B needs to know? Anything you want to ask me on your own? Or do I need to know something about the group or something? And you know what I do then? I count to 10 and I look at all their beautiful faces. I have on my website, one of my small videos is my favorite 10 seconds in school. It's my favorite 10 seconds. And I look at all their beautiful faces and I say, who's looking up and who's looking down and who's looking ready and who's maybe want me to just walk over and give them an extra hello. And after about 8 seconds, oftentimes a kid will say, yeah, Mr. B, wait, can you talk to me, Mom? Or yeah, Mr. B, something happened in the playground. Because they need that time to kind of process and think. And if not, I'll say, okay, let's get to the lesson. But I've made eye contact with almost all the kids. It's only 10 seconds. But it also says to the kids, I am committed. It's not like, okay, if there's anything you get from working with me, don't do this. Any questions? No, okay? Which we do so often. And the message to kids is, I don't want your questions. But if I say any questions, and I count to 10. I say to my kids, you know what I'm doing? Counting to 10. Think time. Most important thing, think time. And all right, no questions, great. Or, yeah, wait, I have a question. Just 10 seconds. Says to the kids over and over, Mr. B actually does want to know what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, what's going on. Mm-hmm. I want to come back to the weight teachers feel of getting through the curriculum. You will get through more curriculum better. With this, kids will be more open to having reteaching, more open to letting you know where they're struggling, behave better, feel more aligned with you, will feel less a chip on their shoulder, less turning the volume down on you when you're trying to give direct instruction. You do this and your class will be more successful. And I will say, all the teachers I know who do rituals like this tell me they're much happier in class. Mm-hmm. You know, that's us. That's for us. The last line in my new book, which is about restorative discipline, the last line is, let's restore ourselves. You do this stuff, and it brings us back to, this is why I want to be a teacher. This is why I wanted to be with kids. I have lost that a little because I've been hammered so much about requirements. I have forgotten that in my classroom space, I have some autonomy, and I can do some things for kids, even when I know I have this curriculum that I'm supposed to cover versus uncover. Yeah. We have autonomy. We shouldn't lose it, folks.
Amen. You're having me think about two books that I reference a lot, and that is Powerful Teaching and Make It Stick.
Oh, Make It Stick.
Peter Brown and Powerful Teaching. I can't remember the author off the top of my head. I will make sure that somewhere along the line that information gets put into the notes. But before we close out today, there's something on your website on the information that you shared with me called 100 repetitions.
This was the article that launched my writing career. Not as viral as a Taylor Swift song, but it's out there. And if you go online and you Google 100 repetitions, Jeffrey Benson, it's going to show up in a few different places. It's on my website. All my articles are on my website. A couple of years ago with my website guru realized that some of the URLs to my websites out in the world had closed down. So we hunted down every one of my articles and they're just on my website. You just click and they're right there. So 100 repetitions, but it's out there in a lot of places. So the notion is, I'm going to give you the short version, is that people don't change, they grow. They grow by being in a safe and brave environment that gives them support and challenges in equal measure. That's predictable. That no teacher should be given the burden of changing a student. What we do every day is we come into school as adults and we recreate the culture of the school, the culture of the classroom. The kids come in, they do their thing. Some of our kids are going to need, and it's metaphorical, 100 times of struggling before they finally get it. Our job is to hang them through those 100 repetitions, to make them a good repetition, so that a kid can struggle and you can have a good day because you did what was right by that kid, even when the kid was struggling. So if you have a kid sharing in your classroom, I might say to you, if the 100th repetition is this kid has reached mastery in what this kid is struggling with, what number do you think your kid's at? And you might say, oh, Jeffrey, I think this kid's like at a 40. I'm like, okay, you're not going to see 100 this year probably, but your job is by next year that the next teacher gets this kid, gets the kid at a 60 or at a 70, which means you took those moments that they were struggling and made it a good repetition. This has relieved so many people of feeling like they were failing because they couldn't change a kid. Because people don't change, we grow. So the article is, you know, I took what my school was doing and wrote it up. I want to say I helped in somewhat of crafting the notion, but I'm a good enough writer that I was able to take it and say, hey, we're doing this amazing thing at the school. We use it all the time. The notion of, wow, good repetition. If I saw Sherry working with a kid in the hall, I could say after, that was good repetition, Sherry. And as a teacher, you would be like, oh, I was noticed for helping the kid through a hard time. I didn't change the kid. I just made that a good experience. So go online, read it. It's only 3 pages. All the articles online are like 3 pages because I know how much time we all have when we're working in schools to read something, share it with people in your school. It's a really good shared language.
I'm really glad that that's exactly where you were going with that, because neurologically, a kiddo who is a gifted student, so with an IQ of above 130,
or whatever needs, IQ really needs, right?
Whatever IQ really means, needs like 1 or 2 experiences to grasp a concept. Right. A bright child needs 5, 6, 7 experiences to grasp a concept. Yeah. A kid with a disability, such like dyslexia, dyscalculia, dyscalculia, ADHD, right, maybe some of the higher level autism students need that 100 times to understand the concept. And one of the things that I've been talking a lot of to the OTs that I work with, mm-hmm, it's those goals that you don't feel like you are meeting those goals and they have to quote unquote rewrite them for the IEP. This is a way of saying, look, this is the experience that they've been having over time. We have gone this minute amount of improvement, but we are improving. No, we haven't met that academic goal, but we functionally are getting much more organized in the thought process to get that experience.
Right. And one of the things that would help teachers is if we had competency-based reporting of kids' progress versus grades. Because what I want to be able to say to parents, to the next teacher or whatever is, let's say it was about using commas in a series, in a sentence, correct? The rubric is, this student can do it independently. This student can do it with a moderate amount of teacher support. This teacher can do it with a limited amount of teacher support. This student struggles to do it without teacher support. That's what we need to be able to communicate versus B plus. I don't know what B plus means. Like, how can we swirl all of the experiences we've had with the class, even for a quarter versus a whole year, and all of the things that go on in kids' heads and all of those experiences and call it A minus? I want to know, do I need to help this kid a lot to do this task, or is the kid close to mastery and I'm just going to give a little scaffolding? That's what we need to be able to do.
Wouldn't that be a miracle to get the grading system to reinvent itself to be more like that? And think about how would look on college entrance essays and exams. And wow, how amazing. I bow to you. Thank you for advocating that, especially with ASCD. Please tell me again, what does that acronym stand for? That stands for
nothing anymore. It used to, you know how some things, they stop relating it back to what the original was? It was the Association for School Curriculum Development. I think that was it.
Yes.
And it was too narrow. Now it's just ASCD, wonderful organization. Their journals are great. Also, for those of you who are interested in starting to do some writing as teachers, and I encourage everyone, we all have some wisdom to pass along. SED has some wonderful blogs, and they're always looking for new writers. I am also happy to talk to people who would like a little mentoring about becoming a writer as a teacher, because we all need to get our stuff out there. We grow together as a community of learners. So,
would you be willing to talk about writing as a professional in a master class for my community?
Oh, sure.
Cool. All right. Well, we're going to have to get that arranged here so that it coordinates when this releases and I can start to advertise that. But that will be amazing. Before we go, I just wanted to reiterate to my audience that I have a course on dysgraphia called the Daughter Dysgraphia Method. And that course right now has been discounted. I have taken all of the coaching that goes along with it and put that into a new program. So if you want to learn a little bit more about the connections between reading and writing and how the disability may look in your classroom, take advantage of that. Go to my website, sherrydotterer.com. And remember, Sherry starts with a C and dot is two T's, two E's. And page down that homepage quite a bit. And when you get to the courses, click on that link. It's going to take you to another website, which is where I house all my courses. And click on that button and start to really think about what does writing look like and how does it connect with the other subject matter. So that's what I'm teaching there. It's not, when I'm talking about dysgraphia, I'm not talking about do I use a gripper or not. I'm talking about what's going on in that brain and how can we apply it to the subject matter at hand.
Love that. So I had a student years and years ago, let's call him John. And John read voluminously and could talk endlessly about what he read. And you had to write book reports to graduate from this school, to high school. And John never could get around to doing the book report. And I would staying up at night wondering, like, I don't get it. So I wrote a list up. It was based for John and it has since been made more generic. What are all the possible barriers that could be getting in the way for John completing his writing? Like, and one was, oh, your younger brother, because you beat him in Monopoly, takes your homework and rips it up before he can get it in. It had some funny stuff in it like that. But it was also things like, I'm scared of grades. I don't know how to do an outline. And it has about 25 things in it. And then I would give it to Lee. And I said, oh, John. Oh, I gave away his real name. I give it to John. And it's all right. That's just a small one. And I sat with him and said, could you read through this? Did I find anything? And the first thing he said to me, because he was like 18, he said, I can't believe you did this for me, which was great, you know. And then I said, yeah, I'm interested. And he went down and he said, here it is. I start writing and I don't know when to stop. He said, Mr. B, I have a journal at home. It goes on and on and on. I have pictures in it. I do drawings. I have stuff like that. You want a 3-page book report? I don't know how to do something that short. It would just go on and on. And so I don't even start because I know that's what's going to happen. So with this student, I said, all right, we're going to get you through high school here. Went into my office. I had a giant whiteboard. And I said, right, let's do all the ideas that you would like to write about. And then I said, all right, we're going to start erasing together. We're going to figure out what feels really tangential. We started erasing until we had about 7 bubbles. And then I was like, okay, what would be the order from one to the next to the next? Let's think logically, because he could do that logic kind of thinking, oh, that bubble would go here. That, okay, we could do that there. And then we made little transition words between the bubbles. How are you going to get from this bubble to this bubble? And he goes, oh, I could do that. And he went home and he wrote his book report and graduated. But I didn't know what it was.
Yeah. And look at that. The struggle that that kid was having kept you up at night. What are the things that you as teachers are keeping you up at night? If you have ideas that are keeping you up at night and don't know how to resolve them, one, you could write down like Jeffrey just suggested. If you're stuck and you can't even get through that, send me an email. It's sherry@sherrydowder.com. Send me an email. Let's get on the phone. Let's have a conversation to help overcome. And who knows, maybe you'll end up taking that course that I have already put together and it goes, oh, I never thought of that.
Yeah. And if Sherry's too busy that day and you're getting a busy signal, we don't have those anymore. Write to me. I have actually the list now modified that I gave that student.
I'm sure you
years
do.
Ago. It's fun to look through. And I know some teachers now who, before they start a class, high school teachers, they give the list to their students and say, let me know if any of these things I need to help you with.
Oh, how brilliant.
Yeah, I know. I hadn't thought of that.
How brilliant. So The Writing Glitch is brought to you on the second and fourth Tuesday of every month, except for the month of July. Please subscribe to this podcast. Write a review. Please, though, if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, hit that number 5, go in and write a review. Let Apple know that this has been beneficial for you. Let Dr. Benson know that this conversation has been beneficial to you. You can always listen to other episodes on thewritingglitch.com or on your favorite podcast app. And remember, you were put here in your classroom with those students for such a time as this. God put that Rubik's Cube together to put you in that class with that kid. So there's a reason he's keeping you up at night for that kid. Sam C., thank you so much for doing post-production for this podcast. If it wasn't for you, it wouldn't get done. So also, when you write that review, thanks, Sam C. Any last comments?
No, this has been great. Be in touch with me, too, through my website. I love spending time with you all.
And that was jeffreybenson.org. Thank you so much, everybody. Have a wonderful day.